Indie Prime, it's Indie Prime on Indie Live Radio. Indie Prime, it's Indie Prime on Indie Live Radio. Well, thank you very much for attending. My name is Graeme McCormick. I'm currently the convener of Dumbarton Constituency Association for the SNP. This is a public meeting, so if you're not a member of the SNP, it doesn't matter at all. And we'd be delighted for your contributions and opinions, just as we're looking forward to the contributions and opinions from the rest of the gathering. We're absolutely delighted that we have basically two giants, if that's not an inappropriate word to describe our two guests today, of the independence movement. We have Joanna Cherry, QCMP, whom I'll speak about in a minute or two. But first of all, I'm absolutely delighted to have Michelle Thompson with us. And Michelle was a Director of Business for Scotland and has a vast experience in public and private corporations, in business generally, and of course was the MP in Edinburgh West. Since then she has founded, along with Roger Mullen, a former SNP MP, Momentous Change, a company which is really very well thought of throughout the corporate world in the way in which they are challenging, shall we say, accepted norms. And she is going to speak on the Heather Project, which is basically the re-establishment of the Scottish Stock Exchange, which is a wonderful example, you know, of what we can do now to show ourselves as acting as if we are already an independent nation. So Michelle's with us, along with her helper, the original wee ginger Doug, who is sitting by our side dutifully. And I would be delighted if you would give a rousing applause to Michelle.
What an amazing turnout. Absolutely fantastic. It's just fantastic to see you all. And it was a lovely drive for me down here today because, of course, I grew up in Bearsden or closer to Mogai. So this was often my stomping ground when we were young and we got cars and we liked to kind of get out and about. So it's lovely to be back. When I got involved, I mean, I've been, you know, hands up, I've been a long-term SNP member since as a girl, really. And when I got involved, like hook, line and sinker in the independence referendum, I said, and I've said habitually ever since, I wanted to use all my skills and knowledge and drive and fundamentally ambition to help shape a better Scotland. And Obama, the then president of the States, wrote a book called The Audacity of Hope. And I like to talk of an audacity of ambition, not a paucity of ambition, which we often hear from our fellow countrymen and women around Scotland. And when I stopped ceased being an MP for Edinburgh West, I said that this sentiment about using the skill and drive and passion for the time being would need to take a different form. And that different form is, there will be a stock exchange for Scotland. Now, I got involved in this. I met the chief executive, a chap called Thomas Carruthers, when I was in Westminster. Now, this was an interesting sentiment, if you like. He grew up in Edinburgh, moved down to Newcastle, went off to Cambridge University, extremely bright guy, stockbroker, set up various companies, very successful. And he said to me, as he did indeed to all the Scottish MPs, I want to re-establish a stock exchange in Scotland. And the interesting thing that I noticed at the time was that some of the MPs, now bearing in mind at that point 56 of them were SNP MPs, some of the MPs said, nah, that'll no work, son. So some, even of our Scottish MPs, were less than convinced it could be done. So the first point I would make to you is starting to take off this hat that we've worn for generations, it seems, where we think, no, it's not for the likes of us. No, we can't do it. We're if you like, too wee, too poor, or too stupid. That must change, and it must change for everybody. The project's been set and it's titled Project Heather. It cannot yet be called the Scottish Stock Exchange until it's fully established and has approval from the Financial Conduct Authority. Now, in terms of the research that myself and Roger Mullen did, you can find it if you simply Google on your computers Project Heather or Momentous Change, you'll be able to read the research we did. And so for today, I'm not going to keep it terribly technical, and I hope not too dull for everybody. So, of course, Scotland previously had stock exchanges. We always did. They set up Glasgow and Edinburgh in 1844, Aberdeen in 1845, Dundee in 1879, and Greenock in 1888. So we had them. This isn't new. They merged into a larger Scottish stock exchange, with the exception of Greenock in 1964, but it shut in 1973. Now, the reason it shut, some people might imagine that it was some dastardly plot against Scotland. No, it wasn't actually the case. There were many small local exchanges throughout the UK, and a decision was made, based out of London, that London should be the central hub. And that's been to the detriment of many areas across the UK, not just in Scotland. Because, of course, when Scotland lost its exchanges, it didn't just lose the capacity for businesses to list and raise capital, they also lost all the infrastructure services that support a stock exchange, such as the lawyers providing services, the accountants, the marketeers and so on. All of that moved to London. So why then? Why a stock exchange? And it depends on where you kind of you come to this. Most of us, for the public, we understand that sometimes you can choose to buy shares in a corporation as part of your savings plan in the hope that they might actually be worth more as time goes on. And we also understand that many of us express the sentiment, wouldn't it be fantastic if we could buy shares in our own local companies? Wouldn't that be fantastic? Wouldn't it be even better? Imagine if our pension schemes, say such as local authorities, could invest our pensions in local Scottish companies, because none of that can be done directly at the moment. But let's think for a minute about why businesses, why is the stock exchange so important for businesses? When it comes to that point, most businesses will seek to grow. They'll seek to increase their turnover. They'll critically seek to take on more employees. So when they seek to grow, they look for additional funding. Now, the traditional routes that are there are actually quite limited. They can take a bank loan. Now, if any of you here either run or own a small, medium enterprise, a small business, the stories of what happened to some of these types of businesses after the 2008 crash are legion. Banks reserve the right to pull in a loan, to ask for it to be paid back immediately, regardless of whether the loan payments are being made or not. Many businesses were caught out after 2008. They were successful businesses, they were meeting all their debts, and they suddenly found that their loan had been pulled in. And the bank contracts, an area that I continue to be involved in, have the specific right to do that, to demand, imagine if this was your mortgage, everybody, can we have that whatever back tomorrow morning? No, I don't have it. That's why I borrowed it from you. But that's what happened to many small businesses. So small businesses now, in general, are very wary of dealing with the banks. So bank loans isn't quite the option it was. The other option for somebody who wants to grow their business and access extra money or capital is to sell it. How many times have we seen that in Scotland? A jewel that's taken all our endeavours, all our society, all our education, often the input of our premium universities to grow, and then they have to sell it? And what happens when they sell it? The intellectual property is lost, the jobs are lost, and they move elsewhere. They could try and get private funding, so-called equity funding. But if any of you have ever watched the likes of Dragon's Den, the equity guys are really, really know what they're about. They demand a high premium in terms of control over the company, and often the owner, blood, sweat, toil and tears to grow that business, ends up losing control. Or they can list. They can list at the moment. They can list on the London Stock Exchange. But when they need to do that, that of course, that means they sack their lawyers and their accountants in Scotland, because they are duty bound to find somebody who is aligned to the Scottish Stock Exchange. And all that goes down in London. Once they've listed in something like AIM, the alternative investment market, and they're on there, it takes two-thirds of the shareholders to decide to move somewhere else. So they're locked into London. So as it stands, and this is an important point, the second important point I would make to you, Scotland has no public market, a public market where literally we, the public, have skin in the game of our businesses, where our businesses are part of our society. We're absolutely unique in that. And it means when our Scottish companies, even when they come to list in AIM, there is no comparable way to assess what they're worth. And that means our businesses, even if they did list in London, are so cheap because we've got nothing to compare against. The 12 comparator countries in the Sustainable Development Commission, all of them have stock exchanges. There's a huge exchange network being developed in Africa. How come all of them have that and we don't in Scotland? So there's a huge advantage to us in having an exchange, and I mean us, the general us, not just business. So what's different about this exchange? There's three main things that you need to remember about it. One, wee bit technical, it's impact focused. So-called impact investing is very much the buzzword of the day. For any of you who've worked in large businesses, we saw the thing called corporate and social responsibility. That was CSR, where it started to occur to some people that actually businesses should look to do good in their society. But what that meant for, say, perhaps a defence company who was making weapons to sell to Saudi Arabia to bomb Yemen, one day a year they had a day out and they perhaps took part in a local fete or they sponsored some charity. That's not really going to change a dime, let's face it. It then moved on to kind of ESG type investments, but again, that wasn't really significant. Impact focused businesses are fundamentally different in that they are developed and run based on ethical, sustainable or good environmental grounds, and they're often aligned to the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals. We know we've got a critical issue with climate change. We know there's things that really, really need to start changing, or we're all in bother. And it's those sort of companies that are aligned to these SDGs, as they're called, that are going to be able to list on this exchange. So it's not just about the type of business, it's how they do their business, how their business links and adds value into their society. The second point is it's global facing. Scotland has a magnificent reputation round the world for its so-called golden thread, if you like, of how it does its investment. When you look at companies like Baillie Gifford, Stewart, Aberdeen Standard, it was Aberdeen Asset and Standard Life, we've got a brilliant reputation. And for a while, if you remember back to 2014, some people were talking about RBS. RBS, what happened there? And with good question. But of course, RBS predominantly was run out of the City of London. About 88% of its operations were run out of there. These Scottish-based companies are completely different, and it's remarkable to me going around the world, meeting people and other things that I'm involved in, and think, Scotland leads the way in ethical investing. So it'll be global-facing, Scottish-based. Absolutely fantastic. We are recognised worldwide as a centre of excellence in investment management. And this distinctly Scottish approach, they call it long-term responsible and engaged capital, is a real differentiator for Scotland. One little kind of fact, if you like, in terms of the economics, and you can read it in our report, as I say, you can just download it. If we did the kind of comparisons against Scotland's gross domestic product, or GDP, and matched it against the exchange in Ireland, and if the trading turnover was roughly the same, it could contribute $19.2 billion to the Scottish economy. I think that's ambitious. That really feels ambitious to me. So that's a what. Quickly on the how. Because people have tried this kind of thing before. Now, this chap, Thomas Carruthers, is really clever. How about we use the infrastructure that runs London, Brussels, Amsterdam, Dublin, Oslo? How about if you use the same infrastructure that runs all of them? Then you don't need to bother about building all, because that's where the complexity is. So all the standard processes about clearing and settlement and so on, it's exactly the same group, Euronext and Euroclear and so on, and again, you can read more about that, that will be used for this exchange. So that means when it comes to the bit where they apply for approval from the Financial Conduct Authority, well, the FCA can hardly say, well, no, that's not going to work. Is it working in London? Yes. Is it working in Paris, Brussels, Amsterdam, all these places I notice? Yes. So that's really very clever of them. Progress to date, they've set up their new head office in George Street, 39 George Street, two floors, one for their kind of trading floor and two to house their, what they call their Genesis programme. Because we have to understand, we haven't had a public market for a long time in Scotland. Our small businesses, and I was at an event the other night, many of whom are interested in listing this, they can really sense what it might mean to them, but they need help with how they actually float their IPO process, if you like. They also need help in what are the things that they need to do to be an impact-focused company. Now, normally when companies come to list, there's certain things they need to demonstrate. Their books are in healthy order and so on, but it's all encapsulated in a term called governance. There'll be extra governance that proves they are of this ethical and sustainable nature I outlined. So an entire floor of this building will be dedicated to supporting small businesses to get there. They've got 15 staff thus far, but their aim is to have about 45 to 55. They've received an RSA, a grant from the Scottish Government in the order of 750,000, which is absolutely fantastic. And they've started making board appointments already. And if you, again, if you keep an eye in the news, they're recruiting people at a rate of knots, and they're very, very good quality people. So, my interest in this, just to finish off talking a wee bit about momentous change, is about the change element, and I'll wrap it all up with what I was saying in the beginning. Until this guy came along, he's independently wealthy and said, this is what I want to do, Scotland should have this, and myself and Roger have been very supportive, and other people getting involved in it as well. There were many people who were saying, no, we can't do this. And there were many people in our kind of local councils, some of our MSPs, some of our MPs. Yes, we can do it. He's been working on this for 2 years, and it will launch, I believe, at the end of this year, as soon as we get FCA approval. Absolutely remarkable, and he's staking everything on this, a lot of his own personal money as well. And that's one of the reasons why I'm determined to give it my full support as well. And just to finish off then, talking about what we do, if I can just be a bit political for a minute. One of the things we did, we organised an event in the Scottish Parliament. And my view of this is, who would not want this to happen? Regardless, because we can do this regardless of whether we're independent or not. We should have this anyway, shouldn't we? So I said, right, I want to try and get all five of the political parties to support this event in the Scottish Parliament. Now, actually, ironically enough, we maybe managed to get four, which was brilliant, because people could all see the benefit of this. But we've got a real situation here where the Scottish Tories in London, and I'm not making this up as a former MP, I know for a fact the previous Scottish Secretary, David Mundell, had said he didn't want this to happen because of the economic benefit it would bring to Scotland. This is an outrage, an absolute outrage. We now have people, regardless of their political views, who are working against our interests. And guess what? That makes me even more determined to throw my weight in any way I can behind it. So I hope you've enjoyed hearing more about it. I'm happy to take questions, but as I say, the technical stuff and the research, you can read it on Project Heather or on our Momentous Change website, along with other research that we're doing as well. I hope you've enjoyed hearing about it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Michelle. We're now going to have our second speaker. And after Jan has spoken, we will have a question and answer session which will be open to everyone here. Jana Cherry is somebody probably that is known not just by everyone in this church or this town or this country, but now globally. She is a global legal star, being the MP for Edinburgh South West. She is a Queen's Counsellor. And also the SNP's Westminster spokesperson on justice and home affairs. As a solicitor of over 40 years myself, and extremely frustrated that the Scottish legal profession does not promote Scots law, which is one of the oldest and the most sophisticated legal systems in the world, I'm absolutely delighted with the work which Jana has done to highlight, you know, what a legal system we have. And regardless of what the Supreme Court decides this coming week, we have shown, and Joanna has shown, that, you know, Scotland has a legal system to be proud of, and each and every one of us, you know, has basically a duty to support that, because it is one of the things which has kept basically our nationhood going since 1707, since we have continued to have that separate legal system. So without any further ado, I'll invite Jana to speak generally on the topic, how we can act as if we are already independent. Jana Cherry.
It's a particular pleasure for me to follow Michelle. When Michelle and I were MPs together at Westminster, we worked very closely together, and Michelle's expertise in business and financial matters has been much missed, both by the Westminster Group and by the party. And I really hope that at some point in the not too distant future, Michelle will return to representative politics either at Westminster or Holyrood, because for those of us who are in the SNP and believe in an independent Scotland, our party and our movement need people of Michelle's ability and intellect. Anyway, it seems a bit odd to be standing speaking in a church, and I started this morning at Church of Scotland service in my constituency in Edinburgh, and I'm finding myself now in an Episcopalian church, and I realise the only church I won't have been in by the end of the day is the one I probably should have been in as a Catholic, because I haven't been to Mass today, but don't tell my mum that if you see her. Speaking today, I'm sort of bookended by two really important anniversaries. Last week, somebody pointed out the same day that the Scottish Supreme Court, as is the correct name for the inner house of the court session, the day that the Scottish Supreme Court ruled unanimously that Boris Johnson's prorogation of Parliament was unlawful, was also the same day as the anniversary of the Battle of Stirling Bridge, which is quite a nice little coincidence. And then, of course, next week we have the fifth anniversary of the independence referendum. And I don't know about you, those of you who were involved in it, sometimes to me it seems a lifetime since that referendum, because my life has changed so much as a result of it. And Scotland, I think, was changed irrevocably by that independence referendum, and for the better. And those of us who voted yes and felt so miserable that rainy day, certainly was a rainy day in Edinburgh, that rainy day of the 19th, very quickly realised that the arguments and the interest in Scotland's constitutional future that had been brought alive by that campaign weren't going to go away. And I don't think they will ever go away until we get our independence. And I think the events of the last 5 years have showed more than anything else, more than anything that ever happened before 2014, why it is so important for Scotland to be an independent nation in Europe. And really, when you look back on it now, it seems that the 2014 independence referendum was just a really a dress rehearsal for what was to follow. And at the time, I mean, I remember very clearly the day that the Yes campaign launched, because it was launched in the Fountain Bridge cinema complex in Edinburgh in May 2012. And my constituency office as the MP for Edinburgh South West is now just opposite that cinema complex in Fountain Bridge. But if you had told me in May 2012 that 3 or 4 years later I would be opening an office across the road as the MP for Edinburgh South West, SNP MP, I would have said that you were completely off your head. And in fact, the day of the independence, the Yes campaign launch, I went along with my dad, who's now in his 80s and has been a member of the party on and off since the 70s. I went along with my dad in fear and trepidation, and we were both dreading the fact. We were a bit annoyed that Alec had won a majority in 2011 and would have to hold an independence referendum because we felt it was too soon, and we were really worried it would be a damp squib and we'd be lucky to get more than a third of the vote. Well, of course, we know that we went from 28% to 45%, and it looked, as David Cameron has underlined in his memoirs published this weekend, for the last few days of the independence referendum, it looked like we had actually won that referendum. And I believe, as I know Alec does, that there was a point when we were ahead and we fell back. But in many ways, I am relieved that we didn't win by only a couple of percentage points, because, of course, we've seen the difficulties that have been caused across the United Kingdom by the fact that Leave won the EU referendum by only 4%, and that people have remained across the UK, and particularly in England and Wales, so divided down the middle over it. And I think when the second independence referendum comes, we're in a much better position to win by a decent and comfortable margin. And the truth of the matter is that the more people we take with us, the better. And that involves sometimes having to say to ourselves, those of us who are very convinced of the case for a referendum and desperate for a second independence referendum, sometimes we have to remind ourselves that not everyone who lives in Scotland feels that way. And that the way that we conduct ourselves in relation to Brexit and the way we conduct ourselves generally in relation to any policies and any policy differences is important in how we go about winning over the soft no's, the people who are not yet convinced of the case for Scottish independence. But I think Brexit is making the case for Scottish independence in a way that really wasn't foreseeable in 2014. And I don't mean by that only if a no-deal Brexit happens or Brexit happens will there be the justification for a second independence referendum. Even if Brexit doesn't happen, if by some unlikely means it is now stopped for the whole of the United Kingdom, I believe that the case for Scottish independence has still been made, and that more and more people are becoming convinced of it because of the way that Scotland has been treated within the United Kingdom over the last 5 years. In 2014, two very big promises were made, well, a number of big promises were made by the No campaign, and most of them have now been broken, and I'm not going to bore you with listing them all, but one of the most important promises they made, of course, was the way that to guarantee your EU citizenship as a someone living in Scotland was to vote to stay part of the UK. Well, that's turned out not to be true. But we were also told that we were an equal partner in the Union, and that we shouldn't leave the UK, we should stay and lead the UK. But it's very clear from what's happened over the last 5 years that we are not an equal partner in the United Kingdom, and we do not lead the United Kingdom at all. In fact, our views are often overlooked, and overlooked in the most peremptory fashion. And we don't have to look very far to see an example of what it is to be an equal member of a union. And Ireland has been mentioned already today, and I know that many people believe that Ireland's greatest saint, St. Patrick, was actually born in this area. I know there's a legend that he was born at Old Kilpatrick, and I know Churches Together in Dunfermline have celebrated that fact. Now, I know not everyone agrees with it. My friend Victoria, who's here, who's a historian, she would say there's not enough evidence for it,
And my dad also, who's a historian, would say there's not enough evidence for it. But there's always been a strong link, at the very least, between the west of Scotland and Ireland. And I think if we look at Ireland's position within the European Union, we can see that that's what it is to be an equal partner in a union, and contrast it very strongly with Scotland's position in the United Kingdom. And I'm not alone in thinking that, because I was at an event in London last year where the distinguished former Taoiseach of the Republic of Ireland, John Bruton, was speaking to an audience about Brexit and Brexit's impact in Ireland and Britain. And somebody in the audience, not me, somebody else in the audience, asked him what he thought about the impact of Brexit on Scotland's constitutional future. And this is what he said. He said that Scotland's marginalisation within the United Kingdom could never happen within the European Union. Because in the European Union, if the European Union was going to take a decision as drastic as Brexit, all four nations would need to agree to that decision. But in the United Kingdom, which is a union of Scotland, England, Wales and Northern Ireland, it doesn't matter that Scotland voted Remain. It doesn't matter that Northern Ireland voted Remain, despite the incredible consequences of Brexit for the border and the peace process. That can simply be overridden. But in the EU, if they were taking a decision as momentous as Brexit, a small country like Ireland would have a veto on such a momentous decision in the same way as a large country like Germany or France. And the EU is designed to protect the smaller nations from the bigger nations running at roughshod over each other. And I'm not saying the EU's perfect, far from it, but I think we see in what John Bruton had to say about that, the contrast between Ireland's position in the EU and Scotland's position in the United Kingdom. And if you look back at what's happened since Brexit, what's happened in Scotland and how developments in Scotland have been treated in Westminster, first of all, the Scottish government were cut completely out of the Brexit negotiations. They had no place at the negotiating table. And you might contrast that with when Canada was negotiating its trade deal with the European Union, when the Canadian provinces had a place at the top table in those negotiations. But we were cut out completely. And then the Scottish government came forward with its plan in Scotland's place in Europe for a compromise proposal whereby Scotland, or perhaps even the whole of the United Kingdom, could leave the political union but stay in the single market and the customs union. And now there's some rumours that that might yet be the solution for Northern Ireland, how to get rid of the backstop. But again, those proposals were dismissed out of hand by the British government. Then the Scottish Parliament, cross-party, all parties apart from the Tories, voted to withhold consent to the EU withdrawal bill. That was ignored, and this principle, this great constitutional convention that had been enshrined in statute that bills wouldn't be passed at Westminster with consequences for devolution unless the Scottish Parliament agreed to them, that was run roughshod over, completely ignored and disrespected at Westminster. And then when the Scottish Parliament tried to pass its own bill to deal with the consequences of Brexit, it was challenged in the Supreme Court, the UK Supreme Court, and while the challenge was pending, the Tory government in the Lords retrospectively changed the law to make sure that that continuity bill would be largely ineffective. And when those amendments to the EU withdrawal bill came back to the floor of the House of Commons, we got 19 minutes to debate them, and the whole 19 minutes was taken up by David Lidington, the then Tory Secretary of State, talking. I think the SNP were lucky to get two sentence interventions. So I think all of those things expose Scotland's marginalisation within the United Kingdom, to use John Bruton's words, our very weak bargaining position within the UK, and the way in which our devolved parliament, the parliament we were told was the most powerful devolved parliament in the world, can have its desires overridden by Westminster if Westminster wants to do that. So I think what Brexit has revealed is that devolution can only go so far, and devolution is a constitutionally fragile thing. And that's been revealed by Westminster pulling powers back from Brussels that should have come direct to Edinburgh, and also by the disregard shown towards Scotland's government and Scotland's Parliament, because it's not, of course, just the SNP government. In many issues in relation to Brexit, the SNP government have had the backing of the Scottish Labour Party, the Scottish Greens, and the Lib Dems. So it's not just the Scottish government, it's the Scottish Parliament, the vast majority of MSPs who have been disrespected by the Brexit process. But there's a positive flip side to that, because this hasn't gone unnoticed. While Ireland's concerns have been central stage for the EU, and Scotland's concerns have been completely ignored by the United Kingdom, people in the European Union have noticed that. And they've noticed that the rhetoric coming from Scotland's government, Scotland's Parliament, and Scotland's politicians is very, very different. They very much were aware of Nicola Sturgeon, remember in the days, it's very hard to remember now, in the days immediately after the EU vote, when there was a sort of void of power at the top of Britain, British government, the person who went out to speak to Jean-Claude Juncker was Nicola. And in those days when there didn't seem to be anyone in control at Westminster, it was Nicola Sturgeon who was on the European stage. Likewise, she and her colleagues at Holyrood and my colleagues at Westminster said to EU citizens, we won't forget you, we will do our best to protect your rights, we will make sure that you still get to vote in elections in Scotland and so far as we can. And then of course it's been people like myself and Andy Whiteman from the Green Party and Alan Smith from my party who've been at the forefront of the legal challenge to establish that Article 50 could be unilaterally revoked, and now at the forefront of this case that I was involved in last week, where the Scottish Supreme Court said that in the circumstances it has occurred, it's been unlawful for Boris Johnson to prorogue Parliament. And I think it's very important, that decision, and I'll say a wee bit more about it in a minute, because if Boris Johnson can suspend Westminster with impunity, how much easier will it be for him to suspend our devolved Parliament with impunity? So we can't let it go uncalled out, and it's really important that the SNP have led the fight to call that out. And I was really proud that when I was at court last week, in addition to Joe Maughan, the English QC I'm working with, the two other petitioners that were with me were Stuart MacDonald and Tommy Shepherd from the SNP. But just to get back to the EU briefly, some of you will have heard in the news this morning that Herman Van Rompuy, the former leader of the European Commission, has said that if Scotland becomes independent through a constitutional process, Scotland's re-entry to the EU will be a technical matter rather than a political matter. Now, that is the clearest statement to that effect that we've had from some senior former European Union bureaucrat. And it certainly echoes what I and my Westminster colleagues are hearing when we travel abroad and speak with politicians from Germany, France, I mean, Ireland is most definitely on our side, but German politicians and French politicians are much better informed now about the position of Scotland, Scotland's responsibility as a democracy, Scotland's good record on social justice, our good record on human rights, the way we've treated our EU citizens in contrast to Westminster. These are all things that are known about across the European Union in a way they weren't in 2014. When David Cameron, all credit to him as a skillful politician, managed to convince many of the other European nations that those of us who wanted an independent Scotland were a bunch of separatist, populist troublemakers. But that has been shown to be very much not the case in the last 5 years, and that the weight of the rhetoric in Scotland is one of social responsibility and of wanting to be part of international institutions such as the European Union. So how do we, in the meantime, while we're waiting for Nicola to pull the trigger in the second independence referendum, we're waiting for that Section 30 order that we need in order to hold a legitimate referendum that will be internationally recognised, how do we live and work as though we were already in an independent country? Well, I always like to think back to that slogan that many of us had on T-shirts and mugs during the Indie Ref of 2014 from Alistair Gray, that we should work as if we live in the early days of a better nation. And that means acting with confidence. Scotland is not pleading or begging for a seat at the top table in Europe. When Scotland chooses by a majority to become independent, Scotland has a right to that seat at the top table in Europe, just as the other countries in the European Union have, if they so wish. People will judge us by our actions, and I think I know from the polling done privately by the SNP that the statesperson-like approach of SNP politicians towards Brexit is winning dividends with us, for us, with no voters. And I think we need to continue in that vein. But at the same time, those of us who are part of the Yes movement need to be respectful and understanding of the fact that there are many people who are very passionate about independence and are desperate for another independence referendum, and not be critical of the people who go on the All Under One Banner marches. I'll proudly go on the All Under One Banner march in Edinburgh on the 5th of October, and I was really glad that John Swinney, the Deputy First Minister, spoke at one in Perth the other weekend. There's absolutely nothing wrong with those marches. Many of the people who go on them are the people who do the hard work that I'm sure some of you do in this audience, the leafleting, the door knocking in all weathers, and they are really just a celebration of the cause of independence. And they're important for our activists and for the people won over already. But how we say, how we conduct ourselves, particularly those of us who are elected parliamentarians, is very important for winning over the yet-to-be-convinced, the sort of person who would never dream of going on an all-under-one-banner march, but is open to persuasion that independence in Europe is the right route for their country. And I think in order to do that, we need to remember always to be respectful in our dialogue and not to fall into the trap of branding those who disagree with us as toxic. That's really important not to do that, because we have to bring them with us in order to win. So I think the job of building alliances in Europe is going well. It's going well for the SNP and the Yes movement. We've won a lot of friends in Europe in the last few years. The real job to be done is at home in Scotland, in winning over, I was going to say our fellow countrymen and women will know, winning over the people who live in Scotland and who are living here and who will get to vote in the next independence referendum, winning them over to the idea that independence is the best way forward for their country. And that's partly why I decided to get involved in the litigation to stop trying to have the prorogation of Parliament declared unlawful. Because sometimes people say to me, oh, Joanna, why are you wasting so much time trying to save the UK or England for itself? Just focus on Scottish independence. But when Scotland becomes independent, we're still going to be joined to England in the same landmass. I hear someone say, unfortunately, well, that is not what I'm thinking at all. But, yeah. But joking apart, we will always have a special relationship. We will always have interests in common. There are many, many people who live in England who share the same values, the same social, democratic and human rights values as we share in Scotland, and we should never forget that. It's absolutely not in Scotland's interest for England to be an economic basket case, nor is it in the interest of the cause of independence for us to have a no-deal Brexit, because if people in Scotland are losing their jobs and finding it hard to get the food and the medicines they need, they may not have the confidence to vote to be an independent country if they're under that sort of pressure. So I believe it's been the correct strategy for the SNP to try and save the UK from Brexit and to persuade England to stay as close to the single market and the customs union as possible. But things are moving pretty fast at the moment. We could find ourselves with a no-deal Brexit on the 31st, and if we come to that point, we may have to reassess our strategy and how we take things forward from there. But it's not just because of the border problem that the Irish are keen to keep England close to the single market and the customs union. Even though Ireland's balance of trade is with Europe now rather than England, because it's been a member of the European Union for so long, and I believe that our balance of trade, when we become independent, will become more focused on the European Union and less focused on England. We're always going to have important interests in common, and I think we have to try. I think working with politicians from other parties at Westminster has been good for me and my SNP colleagues. Apart from anything else, we've got to know the people that we will eventually be negotiating with when Scotland does vote for independence. And a certain degree of understanding and in some cases respect has grown up that I think could be quite useful to us in the future. And also, as I said earlier, as a point of absolute democratic principle, for so long as we're part of the UK, we can't stand by and let Boris Johnson get away with suspending Parliament because he doesn't have a majority and he can't be bothered with the difficulty it's causing him, because we know he could do that to our parliament as well. So that's why I got involved in the litigation in Edinburgh. And I'm very proud of what the Scottish court said. And I actually think that we'll win in the Supreme Court. I think we will win in the UK Supreme Court, because I think the way the Scottish judges approach the arguments is more logical, more modern, and more persuasive than the way that the English High Court did. Because crucially, what one of the Scottish judges, Lord Drummond Young, said was, he said, it's not the job of the judges to politically scrutinise the government. That's not the judge's job. That's the job of Parliament. But when the government prevents Parliament from doing its job by suspending it, then it is the judge's job to look at that and decide whether it was a lawful thing to do or not. And having looked at all the evidence, looked at the lack of candour, the lack of frankness about what the government were about in the government's pleadings, and the various emails that have gone backwards and forwards, and memos between Da Costa and Boris Johnson, the Scottish judges drew the inference that Parliament had been deliberately shut down to stymie, a good Scottish word, to stymie scrutiny, as Lord Carloway said. Lord Brodie said what had happened was egregious and had been done in a clandestine manner. Now, that is really strong language for these very senior, these are three of the most senior Scottish judges, for them to use that language. They have really looked at what's there and drawn an inference and been prepared to condemn it in language such as egregious, clandestine, stymieing parliamentary scrutiny. And I think, as a lawyer, I would say that modern public law is in tune with the idea that the government is not above the law, that the judiciary can review the actions of the executive. So I'm cautiously optimistic that we'll win in London. And while, from a strictly legal point of view, there was nothing in the decision of the Scottish judges that specifically turned on any difference between Scots and English law, and that makes me think it's more likely they will win in London, because it's not because they found on a particularly Scottish point of law, I do think the way the judges approach this is very much in line with the Scottish tradition, going right back to the Covenanters and right back to the Declaration of Arbroath, that government sovereignty figureheads must be held to account by the people. And the way the people hold government to account is through their elected representatives in Parliament. So I'm really, really proud of what the Scottish judges did last week, because I think it is in the finest Scottish constitutional and legal tradition. And I will be surprised if the UK Supreme Court don't come to the same result, albeit perhaps by a slightly different route and perhaps only by a majority rather than unanimously. But I'll just leave you with this thought. If we lose next week, if we lose in the UK Supreme Court, then the UK Supreme Court, doing their job, and I don't criticise them, interpreting the law as it stands at UK level, will have said that it is acceptable under the British Constitution for a Prime Minister who doesn't have a majority to suspend Parliament in order to get his own way. Is that the kind of country? Is that the kind of constitution that Scotland really wants to be part of? Or are we not looking to have something much more in tune with our constitutional tradition? Thank you.
Indie Prime.